The trumpet of Dizzy Gillespie, transporting us to 1947, the year in which World War II formally ended with the signing of the peace treaty in Paris. But 1947 is also an important year culturally. Simone de Beauvoir writes The Second Sex. George Orwell is writing in isolation on a remote Scottish island, and by the end of the year, he's finished the book and called it 1984. Christian Dior creates fashion waves in the US. In music, there's also the jazz greats Charlie Parker and Thelonious Monk, plus Dizzy. In America, un-American activities, that is communism, are being investigated. All of this is described in an intriguing book by Swedish journalist and writer Elisabeth Åsbrink. It's called 1947, When Now Begins. Mostly, it's about the immediate aftermath of the war and the geopolitical legacies of that year, but really contains a lot more wisdom as well. It's very impressive. Elisabeth Åsbrink joins us from Stockholm. Hello and welcome.
Hello, thank you.
One of your claims, Elisabeth, claims to fame, is that you revealed in earlier work the Nazi ties of the founder of IKEA, Ingvar Kamprad. Now, in 1947, with Hitler dispatched, fascists were regrouping, and that was led to a large extent by another Swede called Per Engdahl. Tell us about him, if you would, please, and what he was up to in that year.
Well, the Swedish fascist leader, Per Engdahl, he was up to two major things this year and two secret processes. One was that he was receiving Nazis. They were escaping on a flight route to the northern parts of Germany, over to Denmark and down to Malmö, which is in the south of Sweden. And there he received them and helped them to get transport to Latin America, or actually what was to become West Germany, which is a very strange circle, but that is what happened.
In fact, Hitler's chief Jew hater, as you describe it, Herr von Leers, visits Engdahl in Malmö. Who did facilitate this? Did you ever find out who were the group who made it possible?
No, it's very difficult to find details about this, but it is documented by a Danish journalist that Johan von Leers came to Per Engdahl in 1947, and then they continue cooperation, and it's a part of keeping the ideas alive. And Johan von Leers is one of the people who's then settled in Buenos Aires, and he works on a newspaper there that it's created in 1947 and becomes a very important link between the Nazis in Latin America and the Nazis in Europe. And the interesting thing with this and with him is that he also builds very strong connections to the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, who was close to Hitler and close to the Nazi ideas. And when Johan von Leers have to leave Buenos Aires, he goes to Egypt, invited by the Mufti, and there he becomes the chief propagandist against Israel, working for the Egyptian government. So here are ties going together, merging in a very strange way.
So, Elisabeth, how strong would you rate Swedish fascism or that realm of ideas now? I mean, I think it's fair to say that outside Sweden, certainly, until Stieg Larsson's extraordinary trilogy, I don't think it was known about at all, to be honest.
Well, that's logical, because we've had the welfare state here, and it's been very strong in Sweden, and it's sort of suppressed these ideas, kept them very low, together with other ideas. For instance, in Sweden, we're not very religious. This is another idea that the welfare state also kept down, and the idea of the nation being proud of it. So there are several good and bad ideas that were kept down, and Nazism was one of it.
Thinking of Anders Breivik, who was, of course, Norwegian, and the appalling attacks, very much domestic terrorism from a right, you know, he took on people of a left-wing persuasion. I mean, do you situate him at all in this group you're describing?
Very much so, very much so, because what Per Engdahl and this movement he starts, it becomes the Malmö movement, or in Europe it's called ESB, if you want to Google it. But the Malmö movement, you can find it. And they have this idea, which they partly take from Oswald Mosley, of Europe as a white continent with no foreign elements, as they say, and they mean Jews and Muslims and blacks. And there shouldn't be any democracy because they consider democracy weak and feminine. They want a totalitarian ruling. So this is very short, boiled down, but this is exactly what Anders Behring Breivik has an ideal of. Mm. That's what he left behind in his manifesto. So the ideas are still there. The counter-jihadists, they have the same idea.
Yes. And also, I'm going to move through, because this is your whole point, that there's a lot that we avert our gaze from in this year. For instance, in a meeting in 1947 in an aircraft factory on Long Island, the United Nations was nutting out a human rights agenda, the formation of universal values, or as you write, new thoughts, new premises for humankind, a new morality. And you point out the discussions were led by a 60-year-old woman who had just lost her driving license, namely Eleanor Roosevelt.
Mm-hmm. She's a fantastic person, yes. Well, this is one of the very hopeful things that begin in 1947. The people are, of course, full of the words, they're driven by the words, never again. Never again should anything like what's just happened ever occur again. And they also, they're filled with the idea of universality, that even if we're different, there is something that connects us because we are human beings. And it was on that they wanted to build the new world, the new morality. And that's why Eleanor Roosevelt gets this mission, to create universal human rights. That's actually something very unique in human history. There's been human rights defined in different legal systems, but rights that someone has just because she is born, that has never existed before.
I mean, you can't help thinking about all this with the Rohingya, the plight of the Rohingya in Myanmar being so centre frame at the moment, where, well, the UN, having said never again after Rwanda, doesn't seem yet able to tackle that particular set of prejudices.
Well, I agree. It's awful and appalling what's going on. But, well, genocide is one of the things I describe, because it's also sort of created this year, the crime itself. But just putting words and legal definitions on these things don't, of course, make them stop happening. It's just our way, humans' way, to say this is wrong. Mm. We do not accept this.
Let me tell listeners that Elisabeth Åsbrink, which is A-S-B-R-I-N-K, is speaking to us from Stockholm about her most ambitious new book called 1947, When Now Begins. So let's go to Palestine, because you have a very strong link with this. And Britain, as you say, in 47, has at that point spent £80 million in the previous 2 years trying to sort out what Churchill called, quotes, a senseless, squalid war with the Jews in order to give Palestine to the Arabs. So Britain, the colonial power, effectively hands the challenge back to the UN, and we're still very much dealing with the consequences. So when you look back at all this, what strikes you when you re-examine the history?
Oh, wow. I learned a lot reading about this and the process leading up to Israel's birth. And, well, I think the main insight is that Britain just backed down. They had created a situation for decades, and then when it became too complicated and too expensive, they just handed it over to the UN and said, we don't want any part of the solution, just do whatever you want with it. And what could UN do? They put together a committee, and this committee had 4 months to solve the problem. Well, we know what happened, and I follow this process. So I think I also learned that it was so much more random. It was never fixed in advance.
History's a lot less systematic when you examine it in the present tense. And in Egypt, of course, it sponsored the Muslim Brotherhood, really, well, sort of, that was developing. And Hassan al-Banna, its founder, of course, it had an extraordinary impact on history. Again, what struck you when you re-examined it?
Well, it surprised me that he was so decisive for what we're living with today. He picks up this old word, jihad, which had sort of been lying in a sleeping and not being used. And he picks it up and he inserts what he himself calls the art of death, which actually is the love of death and the idea that dying is also a victory. So it's the whole idea of suicide.
With that amazing resonance with, I think, Osama bin Laden's words, wasn't it? We love death more than you love life.
Well, this originates from Hassan al-Banna. Mm. It's a complete straight line from him through some other thinkers, Sayyid Qutb, and then on to Osama bin Laden, and later on to what we have now. So, unfortunately, this is also a consequence of the British handling Palestine in the way they did and the Islamists reacting the way they did.
And a little side note here, Henry Ford died in this year of 47, and he was the only American, you remind us, mentioned by name in Mein Kampf, Hitler's extraordinarily significant book. I wasn't aware of Ford's anti-Semitism.
I wasn't either. That was also something new, but when you do research the way I've done, because I began reading Swedish newspapers, and then I went on to reading international newspapers, English, French, in some way German. My German isn't very good, but I read them from day one to day 365. And that's, well, you can not read a lot as well. I mean, there is a lot of ads and stuff, but that's when I found this year, and I found the richness and all these small bits and pieces that actually add up to it being very decisive for our time. Yes, Henry Ford, he took the protocol of, what do you call it in
Protocols
English?
Of the Elders of Zion.
Exactly, which is a deeply Jew-hating product from Russia, actually. And he translated it into 500,000 copies so that the Americans could read it. And he was a very great anti-Semite.
I think he apologized subsequently, I think you say.
Yes, but then he went on. And he received a medal from Hitler's hand.
Yes, he did.
A decade after he had apologized. So I can't really see that apology helping much.
And look, you know, I'm just skipping through. It really does. Your book does really remind us about the extraordinary shifts. For instance, in India, Lord Mountbatten, the last Viceroy of India, is positively rushing through partition. In Lahore, gangs of Muslims are burning down the houses of Sikhs and Hindus to drive them out and mutilating people, devastating descriptions that you've got, and so much worse, especially for women. And Mountbatten will later say, and forgive my language, but this is what he said, "I fucked up." So, I mean, Britain's empire is collapsing, and it looked like it was an empire for eternity. So this must have been an extraordinary moment for citizens of the time. We think our time's fluid. This must have shocked people.
Well, it did. It did. I'm not sure that they realised Britain's part or Lord Mountbatten's part in what's happening or happened then. But, I mean, unfortunately, this is another major consequence of 1947 and Britain's handling of it. They sent Lord Mountbatten there to be the last viceroy, and then they also sent another lawyer. He was called Cyril Radcliffe, and his mission was to draw the new lines through the new border lines. And he was considered good for the job because he had never been to India. So there are so many things where actually Britain, where my mother comes from, I love Britain in so many ways, but here they have a major role in these very big processes. And what happened in 1947 is the reason we now have a Hindu nationalistic government in India. Mm. It's all connected.
And Pakistan and the Pakistan-India divide, which certainly bedevils us. This was described very interestingly in that film, The Viceroy's House. Look, finally, this period of history, and especially the impact of the war, is intensely personal for you, isn't it? Your father's family were Hungarian Jews and suffered extraordinarily, and it's very lucky that you're alive. When you stand back and look at your family in the midst of this, do you draw lessons from it?
Oh, I'm not sure one can draw lessons from a genocide, but you carry it with you, whether you want it or not. I did not want this inheritance, but I have it. so I have to deal with it. And this is, of course, a core in a lot of the work I do. It's about, as I write in the pots, it's very private in one sense, because my grandfather was murdered in the most awful way. He was 35 years old, and his body was never recovered. So building this book, writing this book, is kind of building a memorial for me and my father. He lost his father, and I'm my father's only child, so I've been very close to him, and I carry his fatherlessness in a sense, and I also carry his history, because it could have been mine. It is mine. And I've also discovered in a way that we're sort of back to back, my father and myself, because he came to Sweden and he built a new life. He learnt a new language. He became a doctor and he served the Swedish society for his whole life. And he always looked ahead. And here I am, his only child, and I keep on looking back. We're sort of working together in understanding our lives and our survival and the history.
Elizabeth Orsbrink, congratulations. It's, I think, a real achievement, introducing a whole lot of people, I think, to history in a different way. I thank you for your time.
Thank you for having me.
And Elizabeth's name is spelt A-S-B-R-I-N-K, by the way. It's pronounced Orsbrink, but if you're looking for the book, it's a real page-turner. I commend it. It's 1947, When Now Begins, published by Scribe, but that's the actual spelling if you're seeking it out.